The child after death is invisible to the average parent, and to all who have not developed clairvoyance, whereas the parents are never invisible to the child. He can always see them, the astral counterparts of their physical bodies, and often when parents are mourning over the death of a child, the one who is dead is standing by their side, trying in every way possible to communicate with them. To the child, the parents seem to be very dull and stupid at such times, for the child cannot realize that although he can see them, they cannot see him. An often repeated question is, do children grow when they are living in the astral world? This question is always difficult to answer, because if the child is asked, it usually answers, yes, I have grown quite a lot. As I have told you, the astral body does not grow after death, for though the child develops mentally and learns more, the body actually remains as it was when the child died. Growth is only necessary at the physical level. After a person is born, the body grows gradually until it attains full stature, unless the subject dies when physical growth automatically ceases. As there is now no physical body to which the astral body need adapt itself, it too ceases to grow. When the child says it has grown, it means the child thinks it has grown. The plastic astral body immediately responds to that thought and for a time is bigger, but as soon as the thought is dropped, the body returns to its actual or usual size. There is nothing mysterious about this, it is only the working of the laws of nature, and higher matter responds to those laws as well as the lower variety. I once saw a most interesting example of how this works for different people. In the case where a man and his wife died together in a motor accident. 10 years previous to that date, they had lost a young daughter aged 5. The man who had studied occultism, expected to see his daughter looking just the same as when she was alive, so greeted her by picking her up in his arms in the same way as he used to do when he came home from his office. The wife, however, not having studied these matters in any way, naturally added up the years that had passed since the child died and expected to see a girl of 15 years of age waiting to greet her on the other side. She was not disappointed. She saw the tall girl with the attractive face and eyes that she had so often imagined her daughter would grow into and exclaimed as she greeted her, "Haven't you grown? Why, you're nearly a woman now." The husband, knowing something of the peculiarities of the astral plastic matter, was not at all surprised and did not spoil her pleasure by explaining to his wife that what she was really seeing was a thought form made by herself, within which was housed the ego of their daughter whom they had not seen, except during sleep, for the past 10 years. This example shows that although it is a fact that people do not grow in size on the astral plane, yet to those who cannot subscribe to this fact or find it difficult to understand, their illusions prove quite satisfactory and no one is harmed by them. Before finishing my remarks on the life of children in the astral level, let me give you one example to show how the early death of a child can and usually does benefit that child considerably. Two people who were married but in poor circumstances, longed for a child. In due time a son was born to them who lived for just 2 years. The parents were frantic with grief at his loss, and nothing and no one seemed to be able to console them. Life, which before had seemed to be nearly perfect, was now empty and desolate, and the atmosphere of their home was depressing in the extreme. In time they felt the loss less keenly, but the wound was still there, and each made it worse for the other by treating the subject as a closed one, never to be mentioned, which only meant that they both brooded all the more in their inner hearts. The one thing they had both loved, the child whose future they had planned, had been taken from them, and great was their grief, great their feeling of frustration, that they should be treated thus by a creator who was said to be beneficent. This sorrow acted in different ways on the two people. Whilst the woman carried on her household duties and prayed that one day she might conceive another child, the man threw himself wholeheartedly into his business, feeling quite rightly that hard work would take his mind off his great sorrow. 5 years after the death of the first child, the woman produced another son and their joy was complete. As it happened, the new son was the same ego who had been taken from them 5 years ago. Through the hard work which the sorrowing father had put into his business, the material resources of the family were now flourishing, so when the time came for the second child to be educated, the man was in a position to give him a first-class education. 5 years earlier the money would not have been available for this. The net result of this seemingly useless death was that firstly the husband and wife paid off quite a number of units of karma through their suffering, and secondly the child who had earned the right to be given a good education by actions in his previous life, had to be withdrawn from the first body, kept waiting 5 years for the second body and then reborn to the same family. The child's ego did not suffer at all by these occurrences, he gained much by the opportunities available to him in his second body. Being born anew, years later is nothing in the scheme of evolution, but of 10, a few years make all the difference to the conditions ruling in a particular family on the physical plane, which can have far-reaching effects on egos born into such environment. To sum up. Generally it is necessary for a man to return to the home of the ego, which is at the higher mental level, only if he has lived a life in the physical world for an average length of time. To get there he must pass through the astral world, live his life there, then drop his astral body and in his mental body consolidate at the mental level all the mental experiences and intellectual efforts that took place in his last life. This being done, his mental body is also dropped and he does not get new mental and astral vehicles until the time comes for him to incarnate again. I mention this now so that you may realize that a short life on the physical plane often means that the child, having little or no experience to consolidate after such a short physical existence, returns to the astral plane only for a few years, and is then given a new physical body retaining the same astral and mental bodies which it had drawn round itself prior to the recent short life on the physical plane. As you are beginning to appreciate, evolution is a slow process. We would understand it more easily if we could see the schemes as a whole instead of the small part most of us get a glimpse of whilst living at the physical level. There is much that I shall have to teach you about life at the astral level, and I shall give you an opportunity of asking as many questions as you like concerning the points on which you are not quite clear. Before I go on, however, I propose to try out an experiment, with which I think you will be only too anxious to cooperate. Last night I received permission from my master, who is one of the great adepts or perfected men, who help to govern this planet, to give you the opportunity of seeing for yourself some of the conditions about which I have been talking the last few days. It was my master who sent me to you in the first place. What I propose is that you shall yourself go on an astral journey and, if you will do exactly what I tell you, I think I can help you to remember much of that which you see and do during the time you are out of your body. Tomorrow morning, therefore, I shall not visit you as I usually do. You can spend the morning reading all the notes you made of my talks during the past 6 days. Refresh your memory on every detail possible, for you will need to remember a great deal of what I have told you if you are to benefit from the opportunity I propose to give you, in the hope that it will make many things which are now not clear, easier for you to understand. You must eat no meat today or tomorrow nor touch alcohol. I know you usually eat very little meat and seldom drink very much, but even a little alcohol will add to my difficulties, for it will be my job to impress on your brain cells, on your return to your physical body, the necessity for you to remember what you have been doing out of your body. It may not necessarily be completely successful, but we shall try, and since my master has agreed to the scheme, I have no doubt that he will help me to carry it out. Tomorrow evening you must have your last meal at 7 o'clock, go to your room after dinner and be ready for bed at 9.45 p.m. I have here a tablet which you must take when you go to bed, as it will ensure that you are asleep by 10 o'clock. At which time I shall arrive before settling yourself for sleep. Try to imagine what you look like lying on your bed. The simplest method of doing this is for you to imagine that, immediately above your bed, where the ceiling is, there is a huge mirror. Were this so, what would you see in that mirror after you got to bed? That is the picture I wish you to have in mind as you fall asleep, for that is what you will see immediately after you disconnect yourself from your physical body. At first you may be so surprised at seeing what appears to be you lying on the bed, whereas the real you is looking at that physical body, that instinctively you become somewhat frightened, and the result of that fear would be a hurried return to the body on the bed and you would wake up again. I am warning you beforehand what to expect, as I wish to avoid this. Although you get out of your body every night, you do not remember anything about this, because you are not conscious of getting out. Now I am trying to arrange that there will be no break of consciousness at all between your falling asleep and realizing your detachment from your physical body. I shall try to help you to retain that continuity of consciousness, right from the moment of your falling asleep to the moment of your return to your body in the morning. Then you will have no difficulty in remembering and being able to describe in detail all you have done in your astral body during the hours when your physical body remained lying on the bed. Without this continuity of consciousness, you would remember little or nothing of such doings, only bringing back a fragment of one or more happenings, which you would probably describe as a dream. Most people's dreams are fragments of what they have been doing during their sleep, which the brain cells often distort. It is never easy to remember every detail correctly, and it takes years of study, concentration and practice to achieve anything like perfect results. That is why I cannot guarantee that you will remember everything, even when helped by my master. If perchance you are entirely successful, you must not be disappointed if you find, as undoubtedly you will, that on future occasions, when you wake up, you are unable to bring through anything at all. Now I will leave you until we meet tomorrow night. The day after tomorrow I shall not see you either, because I wish you to write down all you can remember of your astral experiences. We shall discuss these when I see you again in the flesh in 3 days' time, at the usual hour. Have faith in yourself, and all will be well. Chapter 4. Part of my instructions were that I should write down everything I could remember about last night's happenings. This sounds simpler than it proved to be, for I can tell you at once that the experiment was successful in every way. I do not know if I have remembered everything that happened. I expect my teacher will tell me that today, but I have remembered so much that I have had to marshal my thoughts very carefully to get it written down. It was a dark moonless night. I went to bed at 9.45 p.m. as I had been instructed, took the tablet which had been given to me and concentrated on imagining what I would see in a mirror above my bed. I have a little French clock, which stands beside my bed. It is a great treasure of mine, for it cost a small fortune when I bought it as an impecunious undergraduate at Cambridge. It chimes both the quarters and the hours with a soft silvery note that has never either stopped or interfered with my sleeping. I had heard it strike a quarter to ten, for then I had taken my tablet. It was just when I heard the first silvery chime starting to herald in the four quarters preceding the striking of 10 o'clock, that I seemed to feel something quite unusual going on in my body. Something inside it seemed as if it were loose, and I felt what I can only describe as a sliding movement, which I suppose was really myself slipping out of my physical body, for before the clock had started to record its 10 strokes, I found myself suspended in space and looking at my body lying on the bed, exactly as I was told I would do, only I was not standing on the floor but perhaps a foot above it. It was really later when I realized this had been so. When I became aware of existing apart from my body, my heart seemed to palpitate, but I cannot say I was exactly frightened, and I certainly did not have any desire to rush back. To say I was surprised is putting it mildly. I was excited. I was thrilled. There was a semblance of fear also, a fear of the unknown, a fear of the unusual. To my astonishment, it was as light as day. This was my first realization of a light which rules everywhere and all the time at the astral level, and although I hardly noticed its character at the time, I found later that it is a blue, gray light. If you can imagine what a room looks like just after dawn is breaking, only much lighter, it will give you some idea of the appearance of my room. I heard a merry laugh behind me, which oddly enough did not startle me at all. I turned round, and there was Charles looking exactly the same as when I had seen him last. Obviously he was enjoying my surprise and my incredulous expression, and his face was wreathed in smiles with all the jolly old wrinkles that I knew so well, showing as in the days that were gone. Automatically I clasped him by the hand. At once I felt that his hand clasp was as firm and as real as it used to be. My Indian friend, whom I had not noticed before but who was also in the room, said, "Yes, he is real all right, as I told you, and because you are using at the moment the same type of body as he is using, he naturally is as real to you as you are to him." My joy at seeing Charles was so great that I suppose I spent quite a minute or two shaking him by the hand, putting my hands on his shoulders and altogether satisfying myself that he was really there, in the flesh I should have described it. I found it difficult to appreciate that although the astral body looks like the physical so far as features are concerned, yet it is not in any way physical and has no flesh, bones or tissues. However, Charles was real enough for me and I started asking him 1001 questions, such as one does with a person one loves and whom one has not seen for some time. I wanted to know how he was, what he was doing, was he happy, etc., and when he could get a word in edgeways, he quietly said, "Don't you worry, I'm all right and having a good time, as you will see for yourself." I commented on his still wearing uniform. "Oh, am I?" he replied, and went on to say that he had not thought about what he was wearing. My Indian friend then explained that I saw Charles dressed in his uniform because that was what he was wearing the last time I had seen him, and so I, unknowingly, had made a thought form of him dressed in his uniform, and the plastic astral matter had immediately responded to my thought. He told me also that even if Charles had thought about what he was wearing before seeing me, I should not have seen him dressed in the type of clothing he had imagined, unless he had mentioned it to me. I would always see him dressed as I imagined he would be. My Indian friend then asked me what I would like to do. Charles suggested that we start with an astral dinner and asked me if I would like to go to the Trocadero Grill, which was a favorite haunt of ours when we were in England together. Naturally I said yes, wondering how it would be managed. But having seen Charles alive, very much alive in fact, I felt that nothing was impossible. "Come along then, let's go," said Charles and began to leave the room. I went to open the door and Charles immediately started pulling my leg about it. He explained that I would have to get accustomed to going through doors on the astral plane without bothering to open them, and although it seemed strange, I found that this was so, for the door offered no obstacle to my passage. As my bedroom is on the first floor, I started going down the stairs in the usual way. I noticed that Charles, who was ahead of me, did not use the steps at all, but just floated down, a foot or so above them, and I found I could do the same. This floating about was certainly a strange sensation at first, but the absence of the force of gravity, to which we are so accustomed at the physical level, soon proved a great advantage and one which one gets used to very quickly. We set out at what seemed a pretty fast pace. I kept close to Charles and my Indian friend was on the other side of me. I asked Charles how he knew the way to England, to which he replied that you soon get used to finding your way about. We passed over the harbour, travelling about 10 yards above the sea. I looked round and saw the lights of Colombo fading in the distance, then for a few seconds we did not seem to be passing anything at all. It was difficult to distinguish the actual places that we passed, for almost as soon as they came into view on the horizon, we had passed them. Apart from this fact, the sense of amazing speed was hardly noticeable, for there was no headwind such as one notices at high speeds in the physical world. There did not seem to be any resistance at all, and I found later that there is none, for the astral matter is so fine in texture, that passing through it at what must be terrific speed, compared with what we are used to here, makes no difference at all. In about the same time that it has taken me to describe this journey, we came to land, which Charles informed me was Old England. He told me that we had taken more or less a straight course, for naturally it was unnecessary to make any deviations, as land or sea made no difference to travel under astral conditions. When we reached England, which I recognized when we slowed down over Dover, I became fascinated with the ease with which we moved. It is difficult to describe in ordinary language, but if you can imagine what it would be like if you were able to travel at any speed you wished, merely by expressing a thought to that effect, that should give you some idea of the process. We had gone up higher as we approached the land, and now we floated some yards above the tallest houses over London. We had left Ceylon shortly after 10 p.m., which was 5.30 p.m. in England. We came down to street level when we were over Hyde Park. I knew it was still daylight, for no lights were showing, but the light of the astral world was just the same here as in the east, where it was night time. I commented on this and was told that as the astral body never requires rest, there is neither night nor day at the astral level. This was one of the first interesting points of difference between the two worlds, which made an impression on me. Charles suggested that I might like to go along Oxford and Regent Streets, to see how it felt to walk in my astral body. To be walking along Oxford Street, where I had not been since 1939, just before the outbreak of war, was indeed intriguing. The street was thronged with people, as one would expect it to be at this time of day. Although the pavements were crowded, this did not seem to make any difference to us, because we actually walked through people in their physical bodies who were traveling in the opposite direction. It is not strictly correct to say that we were unaware of walking through them, for we felt as if we were passing through a small cloud of mist when we did so. For a moment we were enveloped in it, then we were through it and everything around us was clear. The mist did not in any way impede our progress, but we did feel it, and in a similar way when he came into contact with other people using their astral bodies, we felt them to a slight extent, though they did not in any way hinder us. In the world I have often seen a person shudder and in a joking way say that someone was walking over his grave. I know now that this sensation must have been caused by a physical body coming into contact with an astral entity, which, although the astral matter is too fine in texture to interfere with the physical body passing through it, leaves a slight impression. I thought that my Indian friend must look rather unusual in these surroundings in his Eastern clothes, so I mentioned this to him. He replied, "I do not suppose you know that I have changed my clothes. If you will look at me now, you will see that I am dressed in a similar way to the Europeans we see around us." I did look, and it was so. His turban was no longer there, and, as his skin was almost as white as ours, he looked very much like one of the Indian students who are so often seen in London. Because he mentioned it, I saw him as he had imagined himself. He explained that one soon gets used to changing one's clothes, as circumstances make such changes desirable. The plastic astral body immediately obeys the thought, even as it is made. I said I would like to stroll into Selfridges, which we were passing at that moment. No one objected, so we went in and I made my way to the bookstall. I have always been attracted by books, and picking up one of the new ones, I turned over its pages. As I did so, I noticed that there was no gap in the shelf from which I took it, and on inquiring why this was so, I was told that what I was holding in my hand was a thought form of the book I was interested in, the physical one on the shelf not having been moved at all. It was an amazing sensation. I wandered round the huge empty shop, for naturally at that time of evening it was closed to the public, and I heard quite plainly the clocks in a nearby department chiming the hour of 6 o'clock. What a lot had happened in the half hour that had elapsed since I got out of my physical body 6,000 miles away. My companion seemed highly amused at the interest I was showing in things, but Charles obviously enjoyed the unique position of guide, exactly as we all enjoy showing a friend round a new country, as we so often do in the mysterious East, where we meet most of the big incoming liners bringing friends from home on their first visit. Charles said he wanted to show me some of the damage that had been done to London through the raids. He took me to various places, such as St. Paul's, where it was very obvious what Londoners had suffered from these dreadful bombings. It was necessary to travel above the main buildings of the city to see the damage properly, but in our astral bodies that proved no difficulty at all. As we were walking along a street, Charles said, "Come on," and immediately floated over the heads of the stream of traffic. I found it quite easy to follow, as immediately I expressed in thought a wish to do the same, I found myself side by side with Charles floating gracefully and easily over the crowded metropolis of London. He suggested that we have a look at our old home in Warwickshire, which I had not seen for many years, and in what seemed a few seconds only, Charles had steered me to the right spot. I asked him how he knew his way about so easily, having only lived under astral plane conditions for such a relatively short time. He told me that he had made many friends on the other side who had been only too glad to put him wise to the different conditions, and besides this, his training as a pilot in the RAF had taught him quite a lot about going to places as the crow flies. Seeing the River Avon winding its way through the lovely Warwickshire countryside was pleasant, and soon we came down to earth near the spot where our former home stood. How well I knew the old place, even though, since I had seen it last, many small houses had sprung up in the immediate neighborhood. The house still looked the same, even the two lawns in front and behind seemed much as they had been when Charles and I played on them as youngsters. I wondered who lived there now, for after my father died, it had been sold, because my mother was not left sufficient money to keep up the place, and I, the elder son, had settled in the east. I walked inside, for by this time I was beginning to realize that a closed door made no difference, and saw strange people occupying the rooms we had loved in the old days. I suppose it was very foolish, but they seemed to me to be intruders and, with different furniture around, the atmosphere of the house had quite changed. We did not stay very long, but soon returned to London. It was certainly very thrilling to stand in the centre of Piccadilly Circus where the flower girls used to be in the days of peace, but without the figure of Eros, which had been removed to avoid damage. The crowds were still there and the buses and taxis continued on their normal rounds, the only obvious difference was the number of men and women in uniform. In fact, there seemed to be more people in uniform than in civilian clothes, which brought home to me that England was not only a country at war, but a country where every able-bodied man and woman was expected to take his or her part in the defense of their beloved land. It was nearly 7 o'clock when Charles suggested that we have dinner at the Trocadero Grill. We walked into the foyer, where we found that most of the small tables round the wall were already occupied. My Indian friend then said that he would leave me in Charles' care whilst we had dinner as he had other work to do, and he would join us later. Assuring me that Charles was well able to introduce me to this type of amusement on the astral plane, and with a cordial, "Have a good dinner," he left us. Charles explained one of the very important points which must be understood when having an astral meal or drinks in a restaurant which existed in reality at the physical level, as compared with doing the same thing in a restaurant that had been created by ourselves through the medium of imagination or thought. He said that it was always unwise to sit down at a table, which actually existed at the physical level for, as we were invisible, people who came in and saw the vacant table but who did not see us, would naturally take possession of it, which would be slightly inconvenient. When they sat down they would not feel our presence, but the same sort of thing would occur to us as when we passed through the crowds on the streets. When a physical person sat on the chair that was occupied by you in your astral body, you naturally expected to feel something, and although there was no resultant unpleasant feeling, it was not entirely pleasant. It could be avoided, he said, by producing in thought a table for one's own party in a space where, physically, no table stood. He did so right away, in the foyer of the Trocadero, and asked me to sit down. He told me that, by thought also, he would produce a waiter who would appear to us exactly the same as the other waiters we saw moving about on their normal business, but that this waiter would not be seen by the physical occupants of the foyer. He did this, and at once I saw a waiter approaching our table who asked us what we would drink, in just the same way that we would have expected had we been there as ordinary members of the physical world. Charles ordered a dry sherry and a whiskey and soda, for Charles told me that my having been prohibited alcohol for the 2 days prior to this experiment did not apply here. I was supplied with my drink and Charles with his, and the taste to me was exactly what I had expected it to be.